Starting in 1853, children without homes were put on trains and sent west to find families. The orphan trains ran through 1929, and it's estimated that 250,000 children rode them. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the new documentary West by Orphan Train tells the stories of some of the many children who started new lives on a train heading west. We'll hear the voices of some of the surviving orphan train riders and learn about the story of Emily Reese, who made her way west to Iowa when she was 13 years old. I'll talk with her grandson, Clark Kidder, writer of the documentary, and Colleen Bradford Krantz, director of the film. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the 1850s, immigrants were coming to the United States from all over the world. They were looking for freedom and opportunity, but often they found that life here was just as hard as it was back home. The poverty and hardship in cities on the East Coast left many children without the care they needed. Starting in 1853, some children without homes were put on trains and sent west to find families. The orphan trains ran through 1929, and it's estimated that 250,000 children were relocated that way. A new documentary tells the stories of a number of these children. It's called West by Orphan Train, and it premieres tonight on Iowa Public Television at 7 p.m. Clark Kidder is the writer and co-producer of the documentary. Hello, Clark.
Hello.
And Colleen Bradford Krantz is also co-producer, and she's the director of the documentary. Hello, Colleen.
Hi.
And Clark, I know this project was inspired by the story of your grandmother, Emily Reese Kidder, who traveled west on one of these trains. And I will ask you more about her story later in the hour. But first, I think we should get an understanding of what this movement was all about. I mean, there were so many orphan children or children who were not getting the care they needed, particularly in New York City. And you tell that story in the documentary. And Colleen, I get the impression that by some, these children were seen as a scourge. I mean, they were talked about as if they were rats or other kinds of pests.
Exactly. The public sometimes saw them as criminals in a sense, and saw, if they were homeless, saw their parents that way. And this carries on to their children. And some of these children, if they were true orphans or if they were just living in poverty out of desperation, were sometimes, you know, whether it's pickpockets or on the streets trying to find a way to get food, you know, that was seen as a nuisance to many.
So what changed? There was in particular one man who really stepped forward and said, we need to do more for these children.
Yeah, Reverend Charles Loring Brace saw this problem with these children, and he had sympathy for them, and, you know, decided that there had to be a better way. By that time, there were some poor houses, so sometimes the children were in those or various other homes, but the quality was poor. And I think Brace saw that there was an opportunity to provide better settings, and realized that if we can take these children from these crowded orphanages or homes and send them to rural areas or to other areas, other cities where they might be welcomed or there would be families that would take them in, you know, he thought that might be a partial answer.
Now, I want to play a moment from the documentary that helps us understand a little bit of how this process worked. And this is from the beginning of the documentary.
A notice placed in the Hopkinton newspaper days earlier had described the upcoming arrival of a company of orphan children. It said, the object of the coming of these children is to find homes in your midst, especially among farmers, where they may enjoy a happy and wholesome family life, where kind care, good example, and moral training will fit them for a life of self-support and usefulness. Inside the train that day, eight children would have peered out the windows, wondering about this place so far from New York. The group soon made its way off the train and down the block to the Hotel Hopkinton. After changing into the finer clothes they had been given, they were escorted to the nearby Masonic Lodge, where a group had gathered to see the children being offered. The boys and girls were asked to stand and sing a song, recite poetry, anything that might endear them to the crowd. By the time the gathering had ended, each of the eight children had gone home with a different set of strangers.
Again, that's just a moment from the documentary West by Orphan Train. It premieres tonight on Iowa Public Television. And that train, Clark, the one that was going to Hopkinton, Iowa, was chosen for the documentary because that was the train that your grandmother was supposed to be on. She was supposed to be the ninth child on that train. The experience of being paraded in front of strangers and taken home by people who said they wanted you, that must have been so incredibly terrifying for the children. And Clark, maybe you can tell us, was there any kind of a screening process for the families?
Well, there was a somewhat of a screening process. They would, just briefly interview these potential foster parents. They'd often send these kids home over their lunch hour from the local opera house or church where the distribution was to take place, and they'd get to know the family a little bit during that lunch with them. But beyond that, there was little done in the way of any background checks on behalf of the Children's Aid Society that sent these kids out. The agents that placed the kids endeavored to visit these homes a couple times a year to check up on the kids to see how they were doing and so forth, but there really wasn't a lot done in the way of background checks on the foster parents taking these kids in.
Well, and this was a train that didn't have that many children on it. Colleen, there were trains that were much more full of orphans who were looking for homes, right?
That's right. We've heard of some, I think, with 40, I think up to 100 sometimes. Often it varied on how many seats were available because there was an arrangement made with some of the rail companies for, I think, discounted tickets.
So if they were in a group of 40 and they would stop off at a town, then some of the children would have been chosen, then the other children would get back on the train, right?
That's right. They would just continue on. If children were, didn't find a family that would take them, they got back on and sort of kept going.
Now, I think the fact that this seemed like a good solution sheds a lot of light on how incredibly desperate the situation was on the East Coast and in New York City. But the children, as they made their way west and were chosen or not chosen, I mean, this was not entirely without controversy. There were people who even compared this to selling children into slavery, right?
Yeah, it was, it did catch some attention. And I think probably it was based on what you were hearing for outcomes, because as you can imagine, there was a lot of There were some good outcomes and there were some harder stories. So there was some people in the public who were concerned, but I don't know that anyone spoke up enough to put a stop to it. And that might be, again, a sign of the times. It was they were coming from these orphanages where conditions could vary a lot, but sometimes were pretty pretty poor.
Were records easy to come by? I know that there's been a lot of work to uncover this history, but in doing your research, are the records pretty complete?
We had, the Children's Aid Society has some of their records, quite a few, I believe, but they didn't really have one comprehensive list. So I think it's kind of an exhaustive process. And Clark knows that personally, going through a lot of their records as he's finding about his own grandmother's story. And I think the same is with the Foundling Home, which was another group that organized these children being sent on trains.
And Clark, I'm curious. I know a lot of people who came west on these orphan trains never told their families that was how they started. Some people felt that was a shameful part of their past. When did you learn that your grandmother traveled on one of these trains?
Well, yeah, exactly. Many of them just didn't talk about it. Or they were teased really bad in school, too, if the kids, learned that they came out on the train and so forth. So they kind of grew up, also in an era where they really didn't talk a lot about that sort of thing either. Now, my grandma would touch on the fact that she came out on an orphan train, or rather a train, from New York City and was accompanied by a minister. And she'd say that she was placed in several homes and kind of just touch a little bit on it. And it wasn't until after she passed away that I started to hear about these orphan trains, and I thought for sure she must have been one of these little kids that came out, and sure enough, she was.
It's interesting. So much has been learned about the history of the orphan trains, really, in the past 10 or 12 years. I mean, this wasn't even a phenomenon that was talked about a great deal before that, Colleen.
That's right. I don't think most schools would tend to teach about this, and so as a result, I think a lot of people grew up never hearing of this orphan train era. So, you know, if it wasn't something that your generation experienced firsthand, it sort of has been forgotten. And now you see these children and grandchildren sort of digging up these stories, sometimes in spite of reluctance on the part of, grandparents.
Now, I mentioned earlier that about 250,000 children were relocated in this way. So that is a lot of children. How many found homes in Iowa?
I believe that there's estimates that would place it between 8 and 10,000. There's not any one definite number, but we found some numbers from, I think, 1910. At that time, it was around 6,000. And so so the best guess is 8 to 10,000.
And, of course, we also need to think about the fact that the population of Iowa, which is not huge today, was significantly smaller then. I mean, that's a lot of children for this state, which at the beginning of these journeys was really on the frontier.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. And I also think it's amazing how widely it touched the state. I think we estimated that maybe 300 Iowa towns had an orphan train stop at some point or another. And so every county has some connection to this story. So it's really amazing to think about.
And there were some towns that took more children than others. And, of course, Des Moines, for example, there were a lot of children who wound up staying in Des Moines. But in the documentary, you point out that there's a number of significantly smaller towns where there were more than 25 children adopted within the community.
Yeah, that's right. We talk about one town of 700 that had taken in 25, I believe. And now sometimes that means they're getting off the train there, but that still means the children are probably ending up right in that nearby area in that county.
That's a significant portion of the population of kids in that town, really.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. And there were several, a number of examples like that where 10 or 12 children went to one community. Or you'd hear of a train stopping and every child, maybe there was only a dozen, but every child, say in Webster City, every child would find a home.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Colleen Bradford Krantz. She is co-producer and director of the new documentary West by Orphan Train. Clark Kidder is the writer and co-producer of that documentary. He also told his grandmother's story in the book Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider. The documentary West by Orphan Train will premiere tonight at 7 o'clock on Iowa Public Television. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the orphan train movement, which took place between 1853 and 1929. 250,000 children were relocated from the East Coast throughout the United States and the Midwest. There's a new documentary called West by Orphan Train that premieres tonight on Iowa Public Television at 7 p.m. With me this hour, Clark Kidder. He is the writer and co-producer of the documentary, and Colleen Bradford Krantz, co-producer and director of the documentary. And I realize that these trains ran through 1929, but it had never occurred to me before that there are still people who lived this experience who are still alive. So the two of you set out to find people who rode the orphan trains?
That's right. We did an exhaustive search in Iowa to begin with. In fact, I told Clark, I was determined we'd find someone. I knew there'd be somebody that was brought here and still living here. But the case is that there's 50 to 100 that are probably still living nationwide. And so although we do know of some who were brought here and are in another state now, and we did actually find out recently about a woman who was taken to another state but lives here now, it's there's not many left, and so it's a story that you know, we wanted to help tell, even if we needed to interview living orphan train riders in other states to sort of broaden the story.
Right. And there is an organization, the National Orphan Train Complex in Concordia, Kansas, where a lot of this information and artifacts have been gathered. Did you work with them to try to find these individuals?
Yes, we went there to do an interview with a gal there, and they did know of many of those who are still living, but in this case, we kind of searched other ways too, and ultimately ended up interviewing several. But one was a gentleman who lives in Colorado. He was originally taken to Texas, and a woman who was as a child taken to Nebraska, but now lives in Minnesota.
And we actually have some sound from these individuals. Stanley Cornell is the gentleman that you mentioned, who now lives in Colorado. He was born in May of 1920 in Elmira, New York. His mother died of tuberculosis. His dad was a World War I vet who had some serious health problems. He had a sister who ended up staying with family members, right?
That's right.
And then he and his younger brother were taken away, and here he is sharing his memories.
Two ladies came out in a big limousine to us, it looked like a bit, and we didn't have a car, of course, but it looked like a big limousine. And they come in and talk to Dad, and then they talked to us, and asked us if we was happy. And I can remember saying, not really, no, not really. You know, I didn't want to complain, but that was true, because we weren't too happy.
So that was Stanley sharing the experience of being taken away from his home. And we'll find out more about his story and what happened to him in just a moment. But we were talking earlier about the fact that there wasn't really a screening system in place for these families who adopted these children. And the variety of experiences were just all over the place. There were the people who had wonderful experiences and wonderful childhoods, and then people who experienced terrible abuse, people who were treated as if they were hired hands, or some people would have said slaves. And as you were doing all of this research and uncovering these stories, did you get a sense for, I don't know, the outcomes of these placements, Colleen?
The gal who we talked to at the orphan train complex in Kansas said she feels like maybe it's, you know, a half and half, or maybe more positive. And that seems to generally fit what we have heard, I guess. And sometimes it ranges as far as like the difficulties. Some children were treated like slaves in a sense. It was probably common that they were expected to work, which would not be that out of the ordinary, but it was the degree of, you know, what they were expected to do and whether there was any sense of being loved, I guess, in the home. And so I feel like it varied a lot. And you also hear these really happy stories, too.
Now, in the documentary, you actually quote some letters from people who were requesting children. And in some of them, it seemed very normal, especially with the foundling home when people were looking for babies. It sounds a lot like people who are looking for babies today. They say, I want a boy who has blonde hair and blue eyes. A lot of people want to adopt children who look like their family. But there were also some letters that were really creepy. And Colleen, I don't know if you can shed a little bit of light on that, but there, you know, I want a beautiful girl with black curls, and I want her to have a good
That's
singing
right.
voice. And I mean, what were some of the thoughts on those?
Yeah, you did hear stories, and we do include one of those notes that was written to a placing agent, one of those who traveled with the children. And it was exactly like you said, where they went so far as to request that they wanted a girl with curls, and she needed to have a nice singing voice and a good figure. And, you know, of course, oh, if you can also add in that she doesn't freckle or tan in the sun, that would be nice. and it just seems silly, you know, that they'd get so specific, but they feel like, I'm guessing some people came into it, you know, more about thinking about themselves than the children. You know, this might look good for me. I'm sure there's others who were very giving and generous and when they went about doing this or taking these children in, but those kind of letters make you wonder if it was right. Just for show for some people.
Well, and The agent who was placing children who received that letter actually shared some of his thoughts about that too, right?
That's right. Reverend Clark, he thought this was they just wanted a kid to show off, you know, and as he said, a doll to dress up. And he didn't think much of that. He I think, was a kind-hearted person, and he was doing this hoping they'd all end up in good situations. But he heard enough stories over the years as he tried to keep track of all the children he placed that he knew they were not all living with the most giving people necessarily.
Well, and we've talked about the variety of experiences. You spoke to Bernadette Schaefer, who is one of the people who was given to the New York Family Hospital, which was a Catholic organization, in 1923 when she was just 1 year old. And then when she was one and a half, she was sent on a train to Nebraska. She has very, very happy memories, and here she is sharing some of those.
They had the dog Shepherd, and they had cats and dogs and chickens and pigs and baby pigs and oh, just so much stuff that I could play with. I just couldn't believe it. I felt wonderful because I felt that was the first time in my life that I felt like I was, like I had a home.
A beautiful story. But at the same time, she talks about, and you can hear, I think it's her son interacting with her in the documentary, talking about a friend that she visited named Sylvia, who also traveled west on the orphan train and was so angry and so bitter about her experiences. And Stanley Cornell, who's the another one of the survivors that you talked to, he had a very happy ending to his story, but he shared a horror story of what happened to him along the way. And this is him.
Before Stanley Cornell and his brother ended up in Texas, they got a taste of what some orphan train riders endured for years. It was at one of the many temporary homes where they stayed briefly. He remembers riding along as the man who might have become their dad hauled water barrels in a horse-drawn wagon. It was a hot summer day, and Stanley's younger brother, Vic, was soon crying because he was so thirsty.
He got tired of crying and said, "Shut up, shut up, shut up. If you don't, something's going to happen." So he stopped the mules, got around, took us by like this, you know, both of us, set us on the ground, pulled out his penis, and peed in her face.
And that's Stanley Cornell sharing a story of abuse. That's from the documentary West by Orphan Train. And with me this hour, Clark Kidder, writer and co-producer of the documentary, and Colleen Bradford Krantz, co-producer and director. And I want to finish Stanley's story because it did end well. But before he found his forever home and his real family, he went through 6 different placements with his little brother?
That's right. They were probably in each home maybe a couple of months. And he was young enough to not remember details. Obviously, that story he told was such a hard, hard moment that it's clear in his mind. But he had the sense that, you know, maybe they felt like they were too rowdy, or, you know, that maybe they pestered a sibling or something that was already in the home. He doesn't really know, but he just knows they couldn't seem to sort of find a home where they were welcome to stay.
And the fact that he and his brother moved from place to place to place together is nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah, you're right, because it was pretty rare. I think sometimes they made efforts to keep siblings together, but it wasn't, there was no guarantee at all. It was based more on what families were willing to do, that were willing to take in the children. And so I think that Stanley and his brother Vic were very lucky that they managed to be together through all of that.
Can you tell me the story of when he was adopted? He and his brother, again, together were adopted. They were, again, on another orphan train, and they came into a city in Texas. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, they were in the panhandle of Texas, and the a farmer was coming into town that day with a neighbor. They were getting something for his new Model T. And the farmer riding with him says, "You know, you always wanted a boy. That orphan train's in town. Why don't you stop?" And
right, because he had 2 daughters already.
That's right. He has 2 daughters. And, you know, the farmer starts thinking, "Well, you know, I wouldn't mind having a son." So he stops and and ends up going going inside and talking to these two boys at the end of the line. And an agent pulls him aside and says, if you're thinking of taking one, would you consider taking both? That, you know, they only have each other. And sure enough, he ended up agreeing to this. And
without speaking to his wife about it.
that is my favorite part of that story. And it always in our premieres we've had so far, that always gets a big reaction from the audience, picturing his wife at home and having no idea that he just decided to bring two boys home without checking with her. So.
Well, and they must have told this story so many times over the years, because when Stanley is telling it in the documentary, he gives it a lot of detail. He says, you know, she wanted a Singer sewing machine and she thought maybe he was going to buy her a sewing machine that day. And then when we got home, what, he had covered the boys with a blanket that he sent his wife and daughters out to get the groceries?
Yes, it was a cold. It was kind of cold and blizzardy, I think, that day. This father must have a sense of humor, because he decided it would be fun to send his daughters and wife out to get the groceries, is what he said. And and I think it scared one of the daughters when all of a sudden these blankets in the back moved and they, you know, hear these voices. You'll remember how after that, though, it's probably my favorite moment where he says, they carried us in like we were worth $1 million. And you can just hear in his voice how happy he was in that home.
What an amazing story. And what a miracle. And I want to dig into your grandmother's story, Clark, who is, you know, this story is what inspired this documentary. It's told throughout the documentary. And your grandmother had a very difficult path. Her name was Emily Reese. And she traveled west on an orphan train when she was just 13 years old. She didn't make it all the way to Hopkinton, Iowa, on that train with that group of children. She made it to Chicago. Tell me what happened in Chicago.
Well, the minister that brought her out on behalf of the Children's Aid Society was asked by a couple of his friends if perhaps he'd have a child, a little girl in particular, that they could take into their home. So Reverend Clark, who brought my grandma out on the train, said, hey, meet me at Union Station in Chicago, and you can take your pick. So they talked for a while with a group of kids, and at some point my grandmother stepped forward and declared that she'd like to go home with them. So Reverend Clark gave his consent, and away she went with the Parker family.
And now she was 13 years old at this point. What had brought her to this point? Why was she in an orphanage to begin with?
She was placed in an orphanage originally when she was just a few years old because of her father deserting the family. There were 10 kids in the family out in Brooklyn, and the mom was left to take care of all these 10 children, you know, by herself, and just couldn't handle it. So the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children was called, and they took away my grandmother and at least one other sibling, a brother named Richard that was a couple years older than she, and they were placed in the Home for Destitute Children in Brooklyn and stayed there for many, many years. Her brother Richard was fortunate enough to be adopted out of the home in about 1903, but my grandma stayed there, you know, we're talking about 1895 until 1906 when she rode the orphan train. So a very long time.
And in the documentary, you share a little bit about what life must have been like in the orphanage. I mean, there are some remarkable pictures of rows and rows of girls all wearing plaid dresses and aprons. And one of the striking things about that picture is that they all have their heads almost shaved, which gives us an idea that there must have been a problem with head lice or something of that nature. But what did your grandmother share memories from being in the orphanage?
She really didn't. No, the only one she ever shared with me is that she learned how to sew buttonholes and cane shares. And that was about it. She didn't talk too much about it. Fortunately, a little girl that was in the home with her named Mamie Gunderson did write down a lot of her memories of her stay in the home, and she recorded them in a notebook for her family, and the family shared those with with me and gave us a lot of insight into what life was like in that orphanage.
Now, when your grandmother made it to Chicago and she went home with that family, that looked like that was going to be a happy ending, or at least a happy time for her, but it didn't last. Why not?
It didn't. Mrs. Parker developed a heart condition and a tumor, and they had to give my grandmother up. And Reverend Clark was called to come and find a new home for her, which ended up being in Iowa. So she only stayed with the Parkers a matter of, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months, 6 months, and she was off again to another home.
And where did she go in Iowa, that first home in Iowa?
The first home was in Malone with the Pelham family there on a farm.
And we're actually going to have to take a short break, so we'll find out what that home held for your grandmother in just a moment. I'm talking with Clark Kidder. He is the writer and co-producer of the documentary West by Orphan Train, which was inspired by his grandmother's story that he wrote about in the book Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider. We'll find out more about her story in a moment. With me also, Colleen Bradford-Krantz, co-producer and director of the documentary West by Orphan Train, which premieres on Iowa Public Television tonight at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the orphan train movement. Between 1853 and 1929, an estimated 250,000 orphan children, or children without care, were relocated throughout the United States by orphan train. And there's a new documentary that tells the story of a number of those people. West by Orphan Train premieres tonight on Iowa Public Television at 7 o'clock. With me, Colleen Bradford-Krantz, co-producer and director of the documentary. Clark Kidder, he is writer and co-producer of the documentary. And he also wrote the book, Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider, about his grandmother's experience. And before the break, Clark, we talked about how your grandmother was 13 years old when she rode the first orphan train, and she made it to Chicago, where she found a home, but it only lasted about 5 months because the woman in that home became ill. Then she was sent on to Malone, Iowa, to a farm family. What did she find there?
Well, she basically just helped them on the farm and attended school with the Pelham's little boy, and was housekeeper for them. And unfortunately, something occurred. Apparently, she quarreled a little bit with the Pelham's child, and Reverend Clark was summoned by the Pelham's to come and replace her again. So she was then sent to the home of Sidney Brown in LeClaire, Iowa.
And Reverend Clark, in some of his papers and his recollections, he wrote about the fact that people seem to have unrealistic expectations for the children who rode the orphan trains, that the smallest thing would become
exactly
a problem that would get them turned out of their home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He wrote about one little boy that was sent away for swatting a fly and therefore displaying too much aggression in the eyes of his foster parents. Another little boy was sent back to New York for sticking his fingers in some jelly. You know, they just were hypercritical of these kids, unfortunately. And Stanley Cornell from our film even alluded to the fact that they lost a couple of their homes because they quarreled with the little children in the home, much as my grandmother did with the Pelham's little boy in Malone. You know, the extent of the quarreling, one will never know, but...
Right.
Yeah, they were sent away for some pretty mild reasons at times.
Right, often for acting like children, it sounds
exactly
like. So this next home in LeClaire, what was the situation there?
Well, the Browns had a couple boys that were in their late teens, early 20s. And at some point, someone was notified that my grandmother was being mistreated, not being sent to school, not being clothed properly. And Reverend Clark was sent to come and investigate. And he he had to take her away from that home. In one of his reports, he writes, the two boys in the home appear gentlemanly, and he underlined the word appear. So, you know, he's alluding to what may have happened. My grandmother later visited her family back in New York and also insinuated that there was some kind of abuse in that home as well. She didn't elaborate, in great detail, so we'll likely never know exactly what happened, but certainly something not very good.
Right. So from LeClaire, where did she go next?
She went to another river town in extreme northeastern Iowa, in Lansing, to a family of Seventh-day Adventists there, the Kelloggs. And the Kelloggs later moved a little farther west to Waukon.
And this seemed to be a much better fit for her, right?
It did. It did. She lasted quite a while there, actually. It was, two or three years that she was with them. And everything was going really well until the Kelloggs attended a Seventh-day Adventist camp meeting in the woods near Waukon, Iowa. And at some point during the night, they decided they were going to leave without my grandmother. So she was abandoned, essentially, at this meeting in the woods near Waukon.
And before that, they had been talking about moving to Wisconsin. They had gotten permission from Reverend Clark to move with her to Wisconsin. Did she ever know why or what happened?
We don't know exactly what took place. There were, nothing in the way of any details was recorded in Reverend Clark's journals, and nor did my grandmother ever, expand on exactly what happened there. They just simply abandoned her and had no more use for her, is how Reverend Clark ordered it.
Right. So yet another home after that. So some of the people who were at the camp cared for her for a while. And at this point, I mean, she's old enough. Obviously, she was caring mostly for herself. But where did she go after that?
Reverend Clark was called to replace her, and he headed for Milton, Wisconsin. He had a lot of friends and fellow Seventh-day Baptists that had actually founded Milton. And he knew of a family there named the Nicholsons, and he placed my grandmother with them. They had a little farm between Milton and Milton Junction, and this would be her final foster home, as it turned out.
He called her in his letters a self-supporting girl at that point. What did that mean? Do you know?
Well, she was basically of age at that point, and able to take care of herself and so forth. She went from the Mickelson home to another family that attended the same church that the Mickelsons did, and worked on their farm. But at that point, she was of age and no longer under Reverend Clark's care.
So this was more of a,
essentially,
right,
the last,
okay,
foster home.
And with the Courtneys, it was much more of almost an employment, a hired hand or a helper around the house. Although that sounds like that was a happy time for her.
It was. It was quite happy, really. She had a few trials there with them, but for the most part, it went extremely well.
Now, she encountered a man who has the same name as you, so that must have been your great-grandfather.
Correct.
Clark Kidder.
Yeah.
And what happened? How did she meet him?
Well, she had gone to Janesville to run an errand for the Courtney family, and on her way home, my great-grandfather Clark offered her a ride home in his buggy. Grandma was walking along the road, of course, and he had gone to Janesville to sell a load of cordwood to the jail there, and offered to give her a ride home. And when he got home, he told his youngest son, Earl, who would later become my grandfather, that he just met the sweetest young girl with the darkest eyes he'd ever seen, and if he was a young man, he'd look her up.
And so Earl eventually did?
He did indeed, yeah. Yeah, he met her at a Ladies' Aid Society meeting at his parents' home a week or two later, and offered to give Emily a ride around the block, and that was a country block that amounted to about 4 miles. And they got to know each other and started to date.
Now, she didn't, this wasn't a happily ever after at that point. She tried to study to become a nurse. She moved to South Dakota for a time, and then that only lasted about 6 months, and back to Wisconsin because the Courtneys felt like they needed her. And then after a time, they urged her to go back to South Dakota. What happened next?
Yeah, she was kind of going back and forth between South Dakota and Milton because of this, and trying to maintain this relationship with my grandfather at the same time. And they were walking, they attended the Sandy Sink Church, which was near their farm homes there. And one night after church, it was really dark out. My grandma asked my grandfather to walk her home. And on the way there, she began to cry and express her concern about having to move back to South Dakota, where she studied to become a nurse and so forth. And my grandpa decided that the only thing he could do to remedy the situation would be to marry her. So he proposed.
And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but you said that your grandmother talked about coming west on the train. At some point, you put together two and two and figured out that she must have been part of the orphan trains. Did you get a chance to talk to her about that?
Very little, very little. She would just touch, you know, ever so briefly on the fact she was in the orphanage in Brooklyn. She learned how to sew the buttonholes to cane shares, was sent out on a train with a minister and placed with several homes in her families in the Midwest, and went to South Dakota to study to become a nurse and so forth. And so didn't go into any great detail. It wasn't until I traveled back to New York City in 1999 when I was doing research on my book that I was able to obtain copies of her file that they still had at the Children's Aid Society, that I began to learn a lot more about what happened to her and the details and so forth.
And she passed away in 1986 at the age of 94. She and your grandfather were married for 74 years, which is remarkable. They had 6 children, right?
Correct, yes.
And in the documentary, you write a little bit about how devoted she was to her family. Tell me more about that.
Well, yeah, she, you know, as I say in my book, she perhaps realized just how important a family was more than anybody else because of these horrible experiences that she'd gone through during her life. And she really, you know, adored her grandkids and great-grandkids. And at the time that she passed, she had some great-great-great-grandchildren.
Wow.
And she'd always send us a card with a few dollars in it. And just really loved her family a great deal.
She was suffering from dementia for a few years before she died. But when she died, she had with her a token from her childhood?
She did. She did. They generally didn't want these children to bring any keepsakes with them on these train trips from New York. They wanted to just sever all ties with their biological family, but my grandmother was able to somehow smuggle a little brass brooch that held a precious photo of her father in it, and she had carried that with her her entire life. And when she passed away, when I found her that evening, on the dresser next to her bed was this little brass pin that she brought with her on the orphan train and had kept with her for like 8 decades, treasuring it. You know, it was just so touching.
What does it mean to you to have uncovered this story and to understand what your grandmother went through?
Well, I'll tell you, it makes you really appreciative that you've got all the luxuries that you do today. And you know, I had the good fortune of being brought up in a loving family and not being tossed from home to home. It just, you know, it makes you really appreciate what you've got, and it makes you realize that there's a lot of children that weren't near as fortunate. You know, it's humbling.
The stories that you tell about your grandmother getting moved from home to home to home, but the other orphans also, you know, six placements for Stanley Cornell and his brother Vic before they found their forever home. Colleen, a lot of these stories sound a lot of like the stories that you hear from people who are raised in foster care today.
Yeah, you think about the beginning steps might look different, but I think you're right that it's maybe not as different as we think once you get to the homes. You know, you're in a strange setting. You don't know these people right away. There's bound to be some difficult adjustment period. All those would be, I think, true today in the foster care system to some extent.
Although, of course, screening for families is much, much
yes,
more thorough.
Big difference there.
But in many ways, this was the precursor to the foster care system that we have today, wasn't it?
That's right. And I think some of the people we talked to would point out, you know, we want to be so shocked, but it did sort of lead the way to today's system. And as they would say, you know, neither system's perfect. They all have both or all have flaws. And it's just a matter of trying to do during your time the best you can for the kids. And it doesn't always turn out to be the best, but it's it definitely did lead to where we are today.
In the documentary, more than once, you mentioned that you feel like this movement really shaped our society, especially in the Midwest and Western states. Why do you think that is?
You have this large group of children sort of migrating in a sense, and they become, you know, if they stay in the area or wherever they end up, they become the families in that area, and they carry with them the their personalities. And I think a lot of them, it was perseverance. You know, they had gone through a lot, and if they, you know, if they were able to maintain a positive attitude, which surprisingly, it sounds like many did, even if they had really hard times. You know, they bring that with them, that sort of determined sense of I'm not giving up. I'm going to find happiness ultimately, and you know, and then I think they say there's maybe 2 million descendants, roughly, is the estimate of orphan train riders. So you think about that, if they pass it on to their children, I would think that has an effect a little bit.
Certainly. Well, Colleen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colleen Bradford-Krantz is co-producer and director of the documentary West by Orphan Train. Clark Kidder, thank you.
Well, thank you, Charity, for having us.
Clark Kidder is the writer and co-producer of the documentary. He's also the author of the book Emily's Story, The Brave Journey of an Orphan Train Rider. The documentary West by Orphan Train premieres tonight at 7 p.m. on Iowa Public Television. Talk of Iowa is produced by Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.